Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Welcome to First Things First. I'm Ebony K. Williams in for Ms. Jenna Wolf. That is Hall of Famer Chris Carter. Mr. Nick Wright, good morning.
Good morning, everybody.
Good, morning. Good to see you, see.
Can I get some down?
Good to see you, Ms.
Yeah, don't leave me out.
No, we got you. We got you.
Oh, my chair.
Nick was late. I thought it was going to be me and Ebony.
He tried to lock the door on you,
man,
actually.
We was getting ready to do some stuff.
Yeah, okay. All right.
That would have been breaking news.
That is accurate. Man. Don't know if people are ready for that. But we're going to start the show off today leading with a sentence that we have not said since the 2016 football season. Andrew Luck will play in an NFL game today. The Colts kick off their preseason in Seattle with number 12 under center. Now, Luck recently said that he was worried he'd never have fun playing football again, but he'll play the first quarter for Indy. CC, what should the Colts expect or hope to see from Luck tonight?
Well, we want to see a lot different than what we've seen of late. We like to see the Andrew Luck that we saw at the beginning of his career, Ebony, compared to what we saw the last 2 years. We know he didn't play at all last season, but in 14-16, it's up to Frank Wright to build changed identity, him and the new general manager that they have, to change the identity of this organization. And football is a physical sport. Now, Indianapolis, for a long, long time, now, I'm not talking since Luck got there, for a long time, they've gotten away with playing finesse football. It won them one Super Bowl with Peyton Manning. But if they could go back over the Peyton Manning era again, you would know one thing they would change would be the overall physicality of the teams that they put on the field. From years 2014 to 2016, Andrew Luck on straight dropback passes was pressured more than anyone in the National Football League. So that inability to protect one of the great quarterbacks that we had in the league, and then the lack of a running game. If you think of Andrew Luck, and if you think of the lack of productivity that he's gotten in all the games that he's been in, I mean, it's almost a crime to not be able to support him. So all the games that he started, he's only had 3 100-yard rushers in all those games.
In his career.
In his career.
Which is insane. It's 70 games, 3 100-yard rushers. That's organizational malpractice to a degree. And when you go back in a longer lens and look at the Peyton Manning era, I think it is absolutely fair to say getting to two Super Bowls and winning one with Peyton Manning there for as long as he was underachieving as a franchise.
Yeah, and it's just not the how many times they got there. It was how many times were they the best team in football?
And got one and done.
Yeah. How many times did they have home field advantage?
Right. How many times were the playoffs going through what was then the RCA Dome, then Lucas Oil Stadium? How many times were they the one or the two seed and knocked out in the first round? How many times were the Colts a favorite in a playoff game and they lost? Now, Peyton owned all of that blame, essentially. But now that we can look at it, and we can look at a team that I don't think it's fair to say they've underachieved with Luck because of the injuries the last few years, but a team that the last time the Colts had a dominant defense was 1 year in the Peyton Manning era. They had some good defense dominant players. Freeney's a Hall of Fame caliber player. Robert Mathis was excellent. Bob Sanders won defensive.
He had a period there where he was outstanding.
But since they lost Edge, it feels like, they haven't had the consistent running game. Mm-hmm. This year, our friends at Pro Football Focus ranked their rushing attack dead last. So, going into the season. So that is a trend that is going to potentially continue. But Luck can't control that. So what am I looking for? I'm looking for something Andrew Luck absolutely can control, which is and I don't, this isn't meant to sound condescending, but has he learned how to play pro football? We know he can make all the pro throws.
Yes.
But has he learned, due to his injuries, due to being out of the lineup, due to questioning if he'd like playing football anymore, or have fun playing football, that, you know what? Sometimes I've got to live for the next down. Sometimes the best play is an incompletion.
Yes.
Sometimes I need to even Peyton Manning style sack myself instead of trying to brush off the hit. Like, has he learned from what has been, has personally, an incredibly trying last 3 years of playing, not playing, playing, not playing?
That's a great observation because he's got it in his DNA. His dad was a quarterback.
Yep.
He grew up around the league. Now, he is a throwback. He is a big, husky, thick, very, very good athlete. This might surprise a lot of people, but if you look at his combine numbers, size, height, weight, explosive ability in the short shuttle, 40-yard dash, him and Cam Newton, they almost look identical.
The only thing Cam had him on considerably was the 40. But
yes,
all the other stuff and the height, weight, strength, he's right there.
So you're right. At some point, that overall athleticism has to turn into being a pure quarterback, and he can't afford to take blow after blow after blow. So when you're watching the game tonight, if he's getting rid of the football, and even if they're punting, they're winning. Because Andrew Luck's ability to run on and off that sideline is going to determine where this team goes and where this franchise is going to go.
Totally. Okay, so assuming he stays healthy, fellas, how good can Indy be with Andrew Luck?
Well, this is the thing. They're limited. They're limited how good they can be because the lack of overall explosive personnel. Now, Andrew Luck's going to give you a chance. They say when you have a franchise quarterback, you got a chance that he can win 6 or 7 games. So can he get them to 8-8? Because because you got to look. You can't look at Indy absent and look at what's going on around them. Tennessee Titans, we would probably say, has the least amount of talent of the next 3 teams I'm going to talk about. And they were in the playoffs last year. They have Vrabel there as their new coach. So they're trying to turn that franchise away. Jacksonville, to me, is stacked.
Yeah.
All right? They got a good young nucleus of players. Blake Bortles, does he take that next step this year? They don't have a lot of explosive players on their offense. And the Texans are the team that you're like, okay, what can they be? Because they could be 11-5 team, or they could easily be a...
They were 4-12 last year, 5-11.
They can be 6-10.
I mentioned the Colts had the 32nd ranked running game according to Pro Football Focus. The Texans were 31st. They also don't have an offensive line. But aside from that, you love the team. Like their wide receivers, their defense. But I want to talk about the fair expectations for the Colts to answer your question. Because I think some people would say, I mean, the year before you got there, they were 2-14. The next year, they went 11-5. I don't think that is the perfect comparison. I think people underrate how much talent was still on the Colts team when Luck took over. Because that was a team that had won double-digit games for a decade straight. They were now, for them to function at all, they had to have high-level quarterback play. They didn't have it the 1 year Peyton was out, and it all fell apart. But that team still had Reggie Wayne. That team still had Robert Mathis. That team still had at least a left tackle that you had some type of faith in. This is one of the least talented Colts teams that Luck has been a part of. So I think that they go into this year as one of, even with Luck, in the bottom quarter of the AFC and potentially the worst team in their division. But for me, the Colts season is about Luck playing 16 games and does he look like the Andrew Luck we remembered? What I remember hearing, and I can't break this stuff down, but I know Chris can. What I remember hearing about Andrew Luck coming out of college wasn't just the best prospect since Elway stuff. It was perfect throwing motion.
Yes.
Perfect, and you can demonstrate that, but perfect tight throwing motion. I would imagine if you deal with a shoulder injury, you're dealing with strength.
Yes.
Maybe that changes your throwing motion. That's what I would be looking for.
Right. You're looking for something good. And that is, what is the loop that a quarterback takes once he releases the ball? Does he go down with the ball with a big windup, or does he have the short loop that we've seen before where he comes straight over the top? Watching the game tonight, those things will be easy to see. Now, he started off with a smaller football, he started throwing a weighted football, but nothing is like being in the game, being rushed, and throwing that NFL football. So those are things that you have to look for in the game with the Colts tonight. But the NFL is better when certain teams are winning, and guys like Andrew Luck and J.J. Watt, they're healthy, and they're playing for their ball club.
See, you said some there. You said you'll be able to see it, and you did it real quickly. I'm not certain people are going to be able to see it. Can you do that a little slower? Like, because you said when you release the football, you don't actually mean when you release the football. You mean when your left, when your offhand comes off the ball,
yes.
What your throwing motion does.
When a quarterback identifies where he's going to go with his target,
right.
All right? He's going to be holding the ball with two hands in his pocket, in the pocket. Once he sees them, he will take his non-throwing hand off, which typically is his left hand, and then the motion starts of how quick can he get. Peyton Manning, straight from here, off the top. Very, very quick. One of the quickest we've seen. Luck has a very good throwing motion, and it was nice and tight and over the top, but when your shoulder has been through what it's been through, does he take more time on his throw to bring it up to recruit more muscles for his overall arm strength?
More what like Jameis looks like. Like the big,
yes.
I mean, it won't be that bad. Jameis has a huge looping motion. But so to see if it looks as tight as it used
yeah,
to.
Yeah, or almost like you guys, Cam. Cam is somewhere in between Luck and Jameis.
Wow.
Y'all know what
early
I'm talking
in the
about.
Show,
Cam references. 10 minutes.
Cam Dig. Here we go. Now, coming up, are the Warriors, well, they are, say they're done listening to the critics. We'll talk about it next on First Things First. The NBA. A lot of criticism has come to the Warriors this offseason when they signed Boogie Cousins following yet another title. But former Finals MVP Andre Iguodala thinks that the critics are looking at it all wrong. Now, he told Sports Illustrated, quote, "For us, we understand that we have a tight window to build a certain type of culture that will attract athletes like DeMarcus Cousins. And what we're doing is playing basketball the right way. We're attracting a lot of people because they like the way we do things organically. We respect the game." It's a chuckle. Nick, okay, wow, you couldn't even hold it in. Is Iggy right in his defense of the Warriors?
Man, the Warriors are funny, man. This is a funny collection of cats. Like, we're doing it organically.
Organically.
Well, I mean, listen, organic can mean a bunch of different things. Like, in the scientific community, it means carbon-based. Right. You go to Whole Foods, it just means, like, no antibiotics
or
with
like
the food.
$100.
Typically, organically would mean, like, homegrown, I guess, is what it means in sports. The Warriors are a lot of things. Organically built, it's not one of them. I mean, Andre Iguodala, who's doing the talking, he, of course, signed, leaving a 57-win Nuggets team. But that was before the Warriors were the Warriors.
Mm-hmm.
I just want people... The Warriors are now getting... They deserve credit for so many things. But the idea that we have recreated history on how this happened, can we just remind everyone? How do they have Steph Curry on $11 million a year? How do they have a superstar future MVP on $11 million a year? Because the guy had bad ankles. They got him to a discount, which helped them set everything in place. Mm-hmm. Then how else did everything happen? Well, a new TV deal, which allows for a cap spike, and the NBA doesn't. The NBA PA says, we're not going to do smoothing. There's going to be 1 year of a cap spike. What happens the year leading into the cap spike? Well, their biggest competition, OKC, is up 3-1 on them. Klay Thompson has one of the greatest games in NBA history, and the Thunder end up blowing a 3-1 lead. The Warriors then end up blowing a 3-1 lead of their own. Both of those things had to happen to go along with a year-long tampering with Kevin Durant via their biggest competition to all culminate in Draymond Green crying in the parking lot after the NBA Finals begging KD to come join them. All of those things happened and had to happen. Couldn't have happened without Steph's contract. Couldn't have happened without the TV deal. Without KD going there, Draymond does not go there. The idea that Draymond went there because it's culturally the best thing. He went there because no other team in the league had more than two All-Stars. They had four, and he could become the fifth. I mean, listen, they did everything within the rules. Theoretically, they are the champions. But the idea that, oh, no, 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 it's about our ethos. It's about our striving for greatness that makes us attractive. Nah, man. It's none of the above. It's about the game being easier in Golden State than anywhere else. And quit kidding yourself otherwise.
Yeah. Now, you told that story in an organic fashion, considering organic can be anything. One slight correction. I know now that because Boogie came from the Pelicans to the Warriors, he's the villain, but he's not Draymond. Though Draymond was already there. You said Draymond coming.
Oh,
over.
I'm sorry. I apologize. Thank you.
No, but your story was it's beautiful.
Otherwise, the
beautiful story.
Yeah. And very,
right.
very
yeah.
accurate.
Yeah.
Absent of Kevin Durant, all right, the Warriors, and this is where Iggy was right.
Okay.
they do play a brand of basketball that is cutting edge, and it has been grown organically. We never thought that we could have a team that could shoot that many threes, be led by the three ball, but they don't do it just with the three. They do it with ball movement. Now, they have two of the greatest shooters ever, so that makes that system. It's like if you had two great players, whatever system, like the triangle with Phil Jackson, it's going to be successful. Right. Jordan, Shaq, and Kobe, when those things happen, the triangle worked. When you didn't have great players, the triangle didn't look as good. I like watching the Warriors play.
Sure.
They didn't need Kevin Durant, so now the conversation becomes, how good is the system, or is it just a collection of players? So it's hard to enjoy watching the Warriors play since they've added Kevin Durant, but the build-up to Kevin Durant, man, it was beautiful. Watching them win 73 games, it was amazing. But it wasn't as if they were unbeatable then.
Right.
Now when you add Kevin Durant, it's really, really hard to say, well, what is it, the system? Or is it the totality of the talent that they can throw at?
Yesterday was the anniversary of the 92 Dream Team beating Croatia to win the gold medal. What system was that team running? Oh, wait, it didn't matter because they was thumping everybody on the head. Gold medal game, they won by 32 points. It was the closest game in their Olympic run. They did have a great system. Now they can play any system they want. They did have an organically grown team, which, by the way, was not hated. It was the most becoming the most popular team in the league. Everyone seems to understand, by the way, Kevin Durant seems to understand that everything changed when he went there. And the denialism otherwise, it's just ahistorical. Like, this team was not, and one last point on them playing the right way. Forget the winning. There is a brand of the Warriors antagonistic, front-running, whining to the refs, they led the entire league in ejections last year by a mile. That rubs people the wrong way. The way game one of the finals, if we remember, of course we remember the JR, LeBron's great game. But how about Draymond? After playing terribly, Draymond doing the pom-pom thing to Kendrick Perkins, Steph laughing and giggling when the game with the final minute of overtime in LeBron's face. Like, that rubs people the wrong way. That's not about playing basketball
the right way.
We
were talking
about
playing the right way. I'm sorry, because I should have said the way they move the basketball.
Yeah.
They lead the NBA in touches and passes.
And assists every
year. I mean, so it is amazing to be able to see that, especially with talented players sharing the wealth and sharing on the offensive end of the court, and they're one of the top three defensive teams. So how they do basketball that-wise, I didn't explain that part. That part
technique,
right there.
You know about technique. But let's get to it, fellas. The question I want to ask you both, and I want you to just give me a yes or no on it and then explain. They can do it. You said it, Nick. They've done it technically the right way by the book. What they've done has been allowable by NBA rules. But just because you can do something doesn't mean you should do something. So is what the Warriors are doing, and KD and all these guys, is it ruining NBA basketball?
I won't say ruining, but it's not good. So I'm not giving you a yes or no, but I don't think it's good for it. I don't think it's good that one team has five All-Stars, no other team has more than two. There's no team with three All-Stars, no team with four All-Stars. There's one team with five. The guy talking, Andre Iguodala, Finals MVP, not even included amongst that group. Mm-hmm. Like, they've got five starting All-Stars and a Finals MVP coming off the bench. Like, I don't think it's good. I don't think it's good going into the league, going into a season, when the intrigue is about next offseason. I happen to not believe that's good, and so I don't think it's ruining. Ruining's too strong of a word, but no, I don't like it, and I certainly don't like it even more.
No, the ruin part is not true, because the NBA right now is as popular as it's ever been. From a branding standpoint, from a viewer standpoint, from clicks daily, Instagram, Twitter, if you look at all those things, if you look at our show, all right? In the month where we didn't have anything but NBA in the offseason, all right, we did well. So it's doing well for the brand. It's growing basketball. Yep. It's not what we prefer to see. But one thing that I've said, and about LeBron, I said this to Nick recently, was what the Warriors have done, it brought out the best in LeBron James.
Okay.
And he's the best player in the world. So you can say it hurt basketball overall as who can win a championship. Yes, and it's only going to last for a certain period of time.
And maybe that's part of it, and I just need to readjust my eye, because in the last two NBA finals, LeBron's averaged 34, 10, and 10. 34-10-10, the last two finals, and he's 1-8. And in NBA history, that's never been able to be the case. It's always been, if you have the best player in the world at the peak of his powers, if you're not the champion, it's going seven games. It's going, and so it's just so different from what I'm used to seeing as far as
yes, typical. And it's so different than the NFL.
Absolutely. It is. Absolutely. Well, the NBA, here's the thing. It had been so different than the NFL because one guy could do everything.
Yes.
Right? And now it seems like now there's almost the like LeBron, Aaron Rodgers situation where it's like one guy can only do so much. That's not how the league used to be. Like each league had its own charm. That's not how the NBA had been.
Absolutely. Well, coming up, is Baker Mayfield about to prove the Browns right tonight? We're going to see. We'll talk about it next on First Things First. In Oakland, where Khalil Mack's sagas may have reached the breaking point. Now, Mack is due less than $14 million this season, but he says he wants Von Miller money. However, the Raiders might not have enough cash to pay the two-time All-Pro, and he could be forced to deal him away. So, Chris, what do you make of this? How do you see it playing out?
Why you draft good players? You draft them so they develop, and one day they grow up to be like Khalil Mack. Mm-hmm. Like, how are you ever going to get close to being Super Bowl contenders if you let your, not forget good players, great players go? It's hard to find a pass rusher. It's hard to develop. Khalil Mack is one of those. He needs to be paid.
I agree with all this. The Raiders, though, this is a unique situation for a couple reasons. From what I've understood, part of the debate is about he wants a lot of the guaranteed money deferred for 2 years. Why? That's when they moved to Nevada. Nevada's got 0% state tax. California's got the highest state tax. Also, the Raiders are the only team in the NFL. When they say we might not have the cash, they might really be meaning we ain't got it, man. We can put something on it.
Now you make a point.
We ain't got it. Like, we ain't.
Yeah, their owners don't have the strong cash flow. But I did read in the paper come October, the revenue sharing part of the TV agreement, they do get a check, Ebony, for $220 million.
So they're going to have a little something.
And that's more, by the way.
Put on it.
Put on it.
That's more than the entire salary cap. And that's before you sell a hot dog or a beer or a
parka. Put something on it. Now, from the AFC West to the NFC West, Cardinals rookie QB Josh Rosen is going to see his first preseason action Saturday. The team hasn't announced how they're going to divvy up the playing time, but we'll be sure that we'll see some of Rosen when the Chargers come to town. Rosen recently said that he's gotten better each day. Nick, why do you think all the noise surrounding Josh Rosen has really kind of quieted down?
Because where he was drafted. I think going to Arizona, going there, and a market that we don't cover a ton. It's on the West Coast. It's not the Rams. It's not the Seahawks. Not the Niners. I think it's been the perfect spot for him, at least as far as we haven't talked to any Josh Rosen. And the big concern with him coming out of college was not so, you were worried about him being slight of frame, but for a lot of people it was, okay, like, is this guy going to be a distraction? Is he going to be talking to his teammates about politics?
Those are people who've never been in the NFL locker room, though.
Sure, but a lot of those people are in the media, and we have not had a reason to talk about Josh Rosen because of things he has said. Like, I think it's good that the noise has died down.
Yeah. Once you get into pro football, all those little things, that they're not a big concern. Arizona is a good team for them. They're going to be a defensive dominant team. David Johnson coming back from being injured, he will play this season. Not just because Sam Bradford is going to be hurt, because his draft position warrants him playing.
Fair enough. Teddy Bridgewater, he's only played 9 snaps over the last 2 seasons, and he might not get one in New York. The Jets are reportedly open to trading Bridgewater, but only at the right price. So, CC, is this a good idea for the Jets to move on from Teddy?
It's amazing, the Jets. We haven't played one game, and Teddy has looked that good that he only had a couple people that wanted to sign him. Teams wanted to sign him. And the Jets felt so good about signing him, they didn't give him hardly any guaranteed
$500,000.
And gave Josh McCown a whole bunch of guaranteed money. So just slow down on that a little bit. He needs to play this preseason. It's very, very important before you can be talking about what
the right price. The right price for a guy that literally 4 months ago anybody could have had, you would assume, for $1 million in guaranteed dollars, because they got him for $500,000 guaranteed dollars. I hope he plays this preseason. I hope he plays well. And I hope he does get traded to a team where he might play more this year, because I think it's going to go McCown to Darnold in New York, with Teddy being the odd man out. And he's such a good person and such a good story. And he was on his way to becoming, I believe, a really good quarterback before the catastrophic knee injury.
And one thing the Jets should look at if they're going to trade is not a draft pick, but maybe another wide receiver.
Okay. Finally, huge news out of the NCAA yesterday. After that FBI investigation into compensation for college players, seems like the NCAA has taken a big step. They will now allow elite high school basketball recruits and college players to be represented by agents that have been certified by the NCAA. Nick, do you think this is a step in the right direction?
It may be an inch forward. I think that the headline, oh, guys can get agents, is more, it's more grabbing than the actual details. They can get agents, but if they decide to go back to school, they got to get rid of the agent. And while they have the agent, he can't give them any money. He can just pay for some meals and some flights. It also, the way they did in a very NCAA style, ham-handedly, they said, who gets to get agents coming out of high school? The USA Basketball has determined that. USA Basketball said, we are. How? You didn't ask us. You didn't tell us. They did this assuming that the one-and-done rule was going away, which it probably is, but the NBA has not officially done that. The one part of this that I found most noteworthy, though, was that if you are invited to the NBA Combine, declare for the draft, and go undrafted, they are now going to let you go back to school. Now, that would have only affected four guys last year, but I think that is a great change. I think it would be a potentially more impactful change. This is what I want to ask you, Chris, for college football guys. Because there's a hell of a lot more than four guys every year in football that leave early as juniors and go undrafted. Do you think this would be a good change on the football side of things?
It wouldn't be good from a football standpoint because you have to deal with either the quarters or semesters. And typically after the bowl game, guys who are going to enter the draft, they drop out of school because they can't take a full workload. They go to these remote locations, Arizona, California, Florida, and train to get ready for the combine because of the timing of it. And the combine being right there, after the Super Bowl, that now it becomes, am I a student? You know, I can't be a student athlete anymore, so you can't take a full workload. So now you're ineligible. So how does the NCAA do it? You took a semester off of school. So now you don't have the credit hours to continue advancing towards your career, so you'd be ineligible. They'd have to be able to change that. The thing that I worry about is, Nick, what ended my NCAA career?
There was an FBI investigation you got caught up in unexpectedly, and you had signed with an agent and taken some money, and it didn't work out.
Right.
Well.
I had taken money from several agents.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, all right.
Because that's part of the interview process. It wasn't as if I asked them for money.
Right.
You know, I was just minding my own business. It was forced on me.
Yeah, it was forced
this
on you.
Yeah, part of you signing with us, we'd like to give you this.
Some money.
Well, it's just really a bad concept to think that kids dealing with agents, that it's going to be a clean deal. I believe it just continues to muddy already murky creek with the NCAA.
A little caveat, too. The agents have to be approved by the NCAA. And as somebody who used to work in that kind of practice in the legal realm, that's interesting to me. That pay attention to that.
How come? Yeah,
because they are going to likely, because it's the NCAA, cherry pick and qualify certain agents versus certain other agents. And to me, again, that muddies the water.
Yeah, that certification is not too hard to come by. Mm-hmm. You know, so you still get people in something that might be a legal field that don't have legal certification.
Correct.
Because you don't have to be a lawyer
to
be certified.
All of these little inches towards progress are all going to be an inch forward in a 10-mile race as long as you're standing athwart capitalism. Like there are people that want to pay these kids money either for autographs, shoes, for future earnings.
Yeah.
And those market forces will continue to be in play no matter what minor changes you make. And so you're always going to run into
And issues. If you're out there and you're confused, I'm with you.
It's a little murky out there. So throughout training camp, Baker Mayfield has reportedly floored the coaches with his performance thus far. Now he'll look to do it in an actual NFL game. The number one draft pick will reportedly play two quarters in Cleveland's preseason opener against the Giants. Chris Carter, what can we learn about Baker tonight?
I think we can learn a lot because I believe that you learn from your successes, but you also learn from your failure. We're going to be able to see where he is because typically in the preseason they say, well, I'm not going to see anything. You can't hide anything from the rookie quarterbacks because they got to be able to make throws and stuff that they haven't made before. Mm-hmm. They're running NFL offenses. How much is he going to play under center? because that was a thing for him. Hadn't done a whole bunch or any of that in college. But I love to see the young quarterbacks when they have failure, when they don't convert third downs, when they make mistakes. Do they continue to make the same mistakes? But are they X's and O's mistakes, or are they just speed of the game mistakes? And then Nick always likes to mention this. Man, can they get out of arm's way? Yeah. You know, because the speed of the game is quicker, and Baker is a good athlete, but that athleticism taken to the NFL, sometimes they're amongst great athletes. So how does that transfer over, and how does he communicate with his teammates? Because, man, he was a leader. Nick calls him the Pied Piper. Does he still have that type of pull on grown men? Because sometimes we don't see that leadership transfer over to an NFL huddle.
The biggest thing I'm going to look for is before the play even starts, how many delay games the Browns going to have today when Baker's under center? How many timeouts are they going to blow? The hope would be zero on both. Are they breaking the huddle with 14 on the play clock or with 9 on the play clock? Like that communication, that getting the play out, making sure everyone's on the same page, like those are the types of things that I think can be the biggest struggle for these
guys. And this is the first year that Hugh Jackson, the head coach, is not calling the plays. He's turned that over to Todd Haley. So that is something, because we saw in Hard Knocks some of the things as far as practice Todd Haley didn't agree with Hugh on. So we'll see in this first game how they orchestrate calling of the plays and getting in and out of that huddle.
So that's before the snap, and the thing I'm going to be looking for after the snap, and you alluded to it, is I want to see how often Baker cut and runs. Meaning, like, how often does, before he has to abandon the pocket, he says, screw it, I'm out. Like, because that is another issue that athletic quarterbacks have when at Oklahoma. Listen, he was a prolific passer. His second to last year at Oklahoma, he set the all-time passer rating record. And then his final year at Oklahoma, he broke his own record. But he also had the escapability. And that is an asset to have in the NFL, assuming he doesn't get hit like you were talking about. But what we've seen too often from young quarterbacks early is they abandon the pocket before they have to. They are not patient in the pocket. They say, oh, someone's coming. I'm going to try to go out along the right side. Those are the things I'm looking for more than accuracy, more than how good the deep ball looks. Because I trust his arm. I trust that will be there. It's those types of things that I think will be instructive about how far along his progression he really is.
And as you both mentioned yesterday, he's only had like a mock rush, you know, essentially. These have not been real rushes, so we'll see that a little bit better in the preseason game tonight. How do you expect him to kind of respond to that? To your point.
When's the last time he got hit? When's the last time Baker took a good hit?
Bowl game.
Yeah.
You know, when he's in the semifinals in the NCAA. But that part right there, though, he's been playing football since he was 8 years old. Right. So that part right there, he will adapt to. But the thing about getting hit, having some failure, those types of things. I want to see him throw the ball down the field. I want to see I know that take the percentages, throw it down. I want to see him throw the ball deep down the field, because when I've seen Baker Mayfield at his best, it was when he was attacking the defense deep down the field.
I also want people to remember, and because I like for people to be patient with all the young quarterbacks, remember how shocking it is in the long scope that Baker was the number one pick of the draft. 1 year ago, he was a Heisman Trophy finalist. Coming back to Oklahoma, he was not even considered a first-round pick.
No.
The day the season ended, it was Sam Darnold was going to go number one. Then it was, hold up, could Josh Rosen go number one? Then Josh Allen became the guy to go number one. He was, even after he played his final college game, considered by most people to be the fourth quarterback that was going to go in the first round. And he ended up being the number one overall pick. So if there are some parts of him that look very raw or look not pro ready, recognize this ascent, it's not just walk on at Tech, walk on at OU, Heisman Trophy winner. It's even 6 months ago. The idea of Baker Mayfield being the number one pick of the draft sounded crazy to people. And now we've just taken it as a given because that's what happened.
Yeah, but now is the time to start getting paid some dividends from the last 2 years in the draft. We talk about Baker Mayfield, but also I want to see last year's number one pick, Myles Garrett, the defensive end. Man, he looks good. I'm expecting him to have a breakout year. So one on the offensive side, Baker's going to play two quarters. But on that other side, we need to start seeing superstar productivity from the other first pick.
Or the guy, I'm sorry to interrupt, or the guy that they got fourth overall because last year they traded away their number one pick to Houston in Denzel Ward. Like,
yes.
There's a lot of assets that.
And they named him an immediate starter. Yeah. You know, so he's doing well. Very, very quiet guy. Mm-hmm. He's handling his business at the corner position.
I just want to say for the record, guys, I knew Baker was going to go number one.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because after I saw him whipping Nene, that kind of level of swag, that's the number one draft pick right there. I just want to say that.
Good
coming
enough.
Up, are the Cowboys relying a little too much on Zeke Elliott? That's next.
Nick,
first
you know when
first.
I thought he was going to be the number one pick? When he ran for the police like this.
Welcome back to First Things First. We are joined now by Super Bowl champ Chris Canty.
Hey, now.
Thanks for joining.
Up, good morning.
Good, to see
good
you,
morning.
Going on?
Good morning.
I almost ran into him running from up.
That was hilarious.
That was good.
I got to tell you.
I was worried your mic cord was going to get caught on your chair. You're going to go down like Baker did.
Yeah, I had kind of grabbed
you
that.
You kept it going. You're ready to go.
Stayed on his feet.
Still an athlete, CeCe, right? Still an athlete.
So yeah, we are going to talk about one of Chris Canty's former teams, the Dallas Cowboys. Now, we've spoken a lot about their lack of receiving threats, but Pro Football Focus ranks the Cowboys running back group as the fourth best in the NFL, of course, led by Ezekiel Elliott. Zeke will be ready for a full season in the Dallas backfield after a very stressful 2017 season, of course, where he missed six games. Chris Canty, how much of the Cowboys' success will be pretty much literally on the back of Zeke Elliott?
Well, Zeke is the engine for this Dallas Cowboys team, not just the offense, for the team. The one thing I will say about what the Dallas Cowboys have done over the last couple of years is they formed an identity for what they want to do in terms of how they want to play the game, their formula for success, and it's going to be with controlling time and possession, using the best offensive line in football, and a dynamic running back who can dictate to the defense front end coverages, and that's exactly what Ezekiel Elliott it is. Mm-hmm. The proof is in what we saw last year with the six-game suspension. When you saw the Cowboys with Ezekiel Elliott, they were averaging 24 points a game. Without him, 18 points a game. So that's a huge difference. You recognize how he impacts that defense and keeping those guys off of the field, how they actually dictate the terms in which the game is going to be played. Ezekiel Elliott is going to be huge for the Dallas Cowboys. They got to make sure that they have him on the field the entire season because you recognize how he helps Dak Prescott, how he helps the other side of the ball.
As the Cowboys are presently constituted, we have a template to look to as far as the running back success and the team success, and that is Adrian Peterson's tenure with the Vikings. When Adrian Peterson was with the Vikings, they made the playoffs four times. Three of those years were the 3 years Adrian Peterson won the rushing title. The 1 year they made the playoffs without him winning the rushing title, he had 1,400 yards and had the touchdown title. That was the only times those Vikings teams made the postseason. Their running back wasn't a star running back. He was a superstar, best running back in the league running back. And right now, until the Cowboys change something on their skill position guys or add a few more hyper-impactful defensive players, that's the template. How are you going to make the playoffs? Well, guess what? Year one, Zeke, rushing title, 13-3. Year two, Zeke, suspended. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It wasn't the same thing. They're 9-7. I hate to make it that simple, but how do you make the playoffs? Zeke, 1,600 yards, 15-plus touchdowns. You should be fine. 1,200 yards? That's a Pro Bowl season. That won't be enough, in my eyes, for this offense.
Well, I think, Zeke, this will be his best season. And the reason why, because coming out of Ohio State, when you're in that first season, you know, after going to NCAA, man, you play late, then you get ready for the combine, and then you're trying to visit all these teams, you're traveling around, and then he had that whirlwind first season, where during that first season, he didn't lift a lot of weights during the season. And talking to his dad, the wear and tear of the season, that's where he rushed Nick Wood. I think one of the most impressive stats I've seen in football for 1,000 yards on first down. And that was not being able to work out, and you know, being able to lift and maintain your strength during the season. Season number two, the turmoil off the field, where it was not in the best place for him. So this offseason, he's added some more girth. He's been able to get in the weight room. He's as strong as he has been, as they say, bigger, stronger, faster. So I look for him to be more productive. So how can we help him? Tavon Austin, because we know what he can do, run the ball between the tackles. But by utilizing Tavon Austin, not as a wide receiver, but as a speed guy out of the backfield, as a fake reverse, as an RPO guy, I believe that can help Zeke and help loosen up that pocket that's going to be eight guys in the box, seven guys in the box. So if I'm the Dallas Cowboys, I'm going to try to utilize Tavon Austin because I don't want the Adrian Peterson. I don't want them same results. You know why? Because they didn't win in a big way. I believe Dallas's defense is going to surprise some people. But if I make Zeke better, I make him a better receiver out of the backfield, and I allow Tavon Austin a little misdirection to be able to help Zeke continue to pound that rock.
Absolutely, CC. And I know you talked about that wide receiver group. While they might not be as accomplished as the Dez Bryant and the Jason Wittens, the guys that you lost this offseason, they're more athletic. They're going to present more of a speed element. So
yes,
that should help create some room in the box for Ezekiel Elliott. But what the Cowboys also did, they went out and drafted Connor Williams, the tackle from Texas, in the second round. He's going to slide in and play that left guard position. So, again, continuing to make their strength even stronger, fortify that area of the team. They signed Zach Martin to the contract extension. So they're making sure that they protect how they're going to be able to win games, which is that offensive line. Because it's an average team if you don't have Ezekiel Elliott on the field. You saw it during the six-game suspension. They were 3-3.
Right.
The two playoff teams they played against, they got beat to sleep. They outscored 64-16. So the reality is, if you don't have Ezekiel Elliott on that team, on that field, then you're just an average team that's probably not going to get to the postseason.
Let me reframe it. So earlier in the show, we talked about how it's not enough in the NBA or the NFL anymore for basically there just to be one guy, right? Everybody needs some help. Is Zeke enough? You know, I want to ask that question. I know you kind of said, according to some stats, he might not be enough.
Well, I mean, I think if he is, your point's well taken, that even the year the Peterson rushed for 2,000 yards, the Vikings knocked out in the playoffs in short order. He's certainly not enough to make the Cowboys a Super Bowl favorite, to make they need well more than that. Do I think having a guy that can give you 100 yards every game, rushing the football, average a touchdown a game, is enough to be a 10-win team? Assuming the rest of your team isn't in shambles, I do think he's enough for that. And I do think he is. The reason they were a 13-win team his rookie year instead of a 10-win team was it was his production along with Dak never turned the ball over.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like they
your
were
margin
never
of
giving
error.
Away.
Yeah. Like you can win that way, but your margin of error is real, real slim. And now can we depend on, because typically when you have that dominant running game, you play very, very conservative as far as your quarterback. You don't take a lot of the chances. The part that I think that we're missing is how good is Dallas defense is going to be?
That's
and
it.
They've had a lot of good, positive things coming out of camp. I'm believing that they're going to be a top 10 defense and be able to create more time of possession. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Connor Williams at that left guard. Let's continue to pile drive them. Let's continue to, man, let's run the ball up. You can win in the NFL. They can win 10 games by running the football, but by trying to be too fancy, drop that quarterback back 30 times a game. We'll do a stat. When they throw it 30 times, how many times will the Cowboys win? I don't believe it'll be a lot.
Just on a real quick note, CC, when you start talking about how the game is played, if the Dallas Cowboys can maintain possession of the ball and get the lead, that's going to force the game to tilt. That doesn't give the opposing offense a lot of options. They're going to have to throw the ball to catch up. And if you make the opposing offense one-dimensional, that Dallas Cowboys defense is going to be a lot better with Randy Gregory and Tyrone Crawford and DeMarcus Lawrence getting after the quarterback. So hopefully, with Zeke on the field, they'll be able to do that, change the complexion of the game, make it a little bit easier for that defense.
And when CC says they can be a top 10 defense, I mean, last year they were the 8th overall defense in football. Like the year before, they were the 5th scoring defense in football. That last year they had trouble on third downs, which is a terrible time to have trouble. But aside from that, 8th against the run, 11th against the pass. One final question. Just I'm going to throw a name out there and tell me if you think he's going to make any impact. Talking about the running game. Bo Scarborough. He's a name because he's Alabama, but he's a 7th round pick. He's also has got to be physically one of the biggest running backs in the league. Do you think he has any real role in the Cowboys winning games this year?
You can't have enough horses when you're trying to run. He does have a running style. Alabama, it is downhill. Now, he is a big, tall running back. So does he have the type of body lean that's successful in the NFL? Because right now he runs too upright. Now, he does have potential. He's got one shoddy knee. After playing in Alabama, everyone coming from Alabama got a body part that's hurt. But he is a good name and a person to watch because he could compliment Zeke in that power running game because, man, he can run the football. He can run the football now.
All right.
Bo Scarborough, Tuscaloosa High School.
You going to stay with us here? Coming up, is Andrew Luck going to return to the
league? He was trying to be a
wide receiver. We'll talk about it next. So first things first. Here on First Things First with Chris Canty. Now, how about this for a sentence that has not been said since the 2016 football season? Andrew Luck will play in an NFL game today. The Colts kick off their preseason in Seattle with number 12 under center. Now, Luck, who recently said that he was worried he'd never enjoy playing football again, will play the first quarter for Indy. Chris Canty, what should the Colts hope to see from Andrew Luck tonight?
Well, I think they just want to see him knock some of the rust off. He hadn't played football in over a year and a half. So there's going to be a little bit of an adjustment just because of the speed of it. You know, when you start talking about practice speed, that's different from game speed. Even though it's the preseason, there's a little uptick in tempo. And so just have Andrew Luck adjust to that, being able to knock some of the rust off, making sure from a psychology standpoint that he takes those couple of hits and he's able to work past that. Because as a player coming back from a major injury, it's always a situation where you want to get some confidence. And the only way that you can trust that you're all the way back is by making sure you take a hit on that injury and then you bounce back up and you can continue to go out there and do your job. I think from an X's and O's standpoint, you're probably going to look for him just to operate the offense, just get used to the pre-snap reads, getting in and out of the huddle, making the calls at the line of scrimmage. But I think the biggest thing is just to let Andrew Luck get a feel for playing NFL football again.
He's also got a new coach, new offensive coordinator, so it's their first time all of them collectively playing together. So you mentioned the rust. How would we be able to tell as fans if he's rusty? Well, his overall accuracy. Watch his ball placement. What you'd like to be able to do in a situation like this, the offensive coordinator, you know, you'd like to be able to generate some first downs. Try to get a little sequence, a little rhythm, because the more rhythm you get, the more you get out of Andrew Luck in the intangibles. Him coming in and out of the huddle, because it's important as a player on that offense that you hear that voice. That guy, that we know we got that guy. And Andrew Luck is that guy. I coached him. I was the Pro Bowl. I was the honorary captain for the Pro Bowl. Andrew Luck was one of the first selections. And I knew with having Harbaugh as my coach, having Luck as my quarterback, I didn't have a whole bunch of stuff I had to worry about with guys. Man, he is on top of guys. People think that he's an all shucks. No, no, he is a great leader. He's vocal. And if I see that same type of guy, you don't get that if you don't get the first down. So those are some of the things that I want to see him verbalizing, taking back command of that huddle, taking back command of that organization. And you can only do that if you're able to generate some first downs.
And what can be so frustrating for fans and even more so for coaches in these preseason games is if they're like, with Luck, he's going to play more than most. But if the theory is, I want to see my first team unit out there for 12 plays, if that means they got to be out there for three drives because it's three and out, it's a first down and then a punt. And a lot of times that's because you run the ball on first down, you lose a yard, now you're in second and 11, and it leads to a quick drive. And that's going to be the question for the Colts tonight, absent Andrew Luck, and the Colts all year long, absent Andrew Luck. Do they have any threat of a running game? Like, does Marlon Mack do anything for you? Is Pro Football Focus right when they say they have the dead last rushing attack in all of the NFL? Like, that is something that Luck can't control. Now, what Luck can control is how smart he plays. Now, he's obviously a very smart football player, but at times he would make dumb decisions. And I'm not talking about interceptions. I'm not talking about misreading coverages. Okay. And I'm not even talking about trying to fit a ball into a window he shouldn't, because I don't mind the Peyton Manning, Brett Favre to the extreme style of there's going to be some picks because there's going to be a high reward going with the high risk. I'm talking about throw it away. Should I throw it away? Bam, I got hit. That's what I'm talking about, where Luck ran himself into some trouble over basically the entirety of his career.
Well, I think the issue with that is he recognized that he didn't have the best supporting cast out there, so he was trying to do a little too much. But you would think that coming off this injury and just having a chance to digest what happened to him, process that, you realize how valuable he is to this franchise and that they're not going to be competitive without him on the field. So the best ability that he has is availability. So that's the biggest thing for Andrew Luck, making sure that he understands that. Now, I think the front office and ownership understands that, because you look at what they've done in the draft the last couple of years, being able to get the center out of Alabama, Ryan Kelly, and then getting Quentin Nelson and Braden Smith in this year's draft. I think those guys are going to be key. Again, the guard center guard combination, that's the fabric of the pocket. That's also the heart of the run game. So if you want to have balance for Andrew Luck, you want to have protection for Andrew Luck, that group is going to have to play well.
Following up, Chris Canty, on your point of availability, let's say he stays healthy, that helps him out in that way. How good can the Colts be with him?
Well, they're in a tough division. You look at the AFC South, the Jacksonville Jaguars, they have an all-world defense. I don't trust their quarterback, but, I mean, it is what it is. They were in the AFC Championship game last year. The Houston Texans with Deshaun Watson coming back, a really good defense, a sneaky good defense if everybody's healthy. And then you look at what the Tennessee Titans did, a playoff team from a year ago. They got a new head coach, some moving parts. But it's going to be a competitive division. So I don't know that the Indianapolis Colts are going to be in a situation where they're competing for the postseason, but I think that this is going to be a year where they're going to be more competitive, certainly more competitive than what we've seen in the last couple of years.
Any team could win the AFC South, but the Colts are the one team that it would shock me. Like, the Colts are the team that would surprise me the absolute most. Because you look
at the least talent.
They have the least talent. You look at the Titans. The Titans, as you mentioned, were a playoff team and felt they underachieved enough they fired their coach.
Yes.
You know what I mean? The Texans have – we were talking before the show about candidates for comeback player of the year. Texans got four of them on their own team. They also added a key contributor from Jacksonville in Colvin, the nickel corner, brought him over. And then there's the Jags, who you think after their giant win improvement, a seven-game improvement from 16 to 17, that they want to continue on that improvement. So the Colts, to me, Luck's success this year, he's one of the rare quarterbacks. It will not be about the team winning losses. It'll be about, does he look like Andrew Luck again?
Does he look like Andrew Luck, and can they change the lack of physicality as far as this organization? They played this way for a long, long time. And you mentioned Peyton Manning, they only got one Super Bowl win out of that. You have to be able to change your identity with Luck. You got to be able to protect him. He can't be the most pressured quarterback inside the pocket, and he can't go over the next 70 games and only have 300-yard rushers, which he had in the previous 70 starts. Like, that is a crime in itself. So let's get this franchise back on the right track.
All right. Chris Kane, we're going to see you a little bit later in the show. Sticking around. But next, has Tiger Woods somehow flown under the radar as he heads into the PGA Championship? We'll talk about it next on First Things First. Let's talk about Tiger Woods. Now, Tiger tees off in the PGA Championship today at 9:23. The trio of Tiger Woods, Rory McIlroy, and Justin Thomas will certainly be the highlight of day one. Currently, Tiger has the 10th best odds to win at 28-1. So, CeCe, how important is the PGA Championship for Tiger here?
Well, the PGA, it's very, very important because he's trying to finish up the regular season strong, where he can potentially make the Ryder Cup. He hadn't qualified. Those in the golfing business think that he will get one of those wild card picks from the captain to be able to play on. But we just have to just slow down for just a second. Tiger did have the lead in the British Open in the fourth round. We all got excited. Yep. My partner here, no one's more excited about Tiger Woods than Nick Wright. He's winning every golf tournament. He's making a comeback. Okay, just slow down, Nick. Uh-huh. Tiger has had a remarkable season. He's the only man in the history of the PGA Tour to play with a fused back. Now, somewhere over the last two or three months, we seem to have forgotten this. I just wanted Tiger to win this season. It didn't have to be a major. Just get back in the winning circle. But to see him play and to see he's been consistent enough that it's been a great year. I don't think the PGA, which is not his favorite of the championships to be able to win, why it doesn't set up the way Tiger likes to play golf. The rough is going to be really high. He's still struggling with his driver. So I don't have great expectations for him this weekend. I expect him to make the cut. I expect him to finish in the top 20. And that would just continue on what has been a tremendous, tremendous comeback in 2018.
The top 20 finish, while it would disappoint me, because you're right, I pick Tiger to win every tournament, every major, and I have for almost 20 years, it would be a continued step in the right direction. The Masters, he was tied for 32nd. He got cut from the U.S. Open after the disastrous start, triple bogey on the first hole to start the U.S. Open. And then the British, I mean, you mentioned it. I thought we had it. I thought we had the Tiger on Sunday moment, and he couldn't quite close. So I'm curious, and I think a lot of people are curious about how this course sets up, because Belrive is, I mean, the last tournament it hosted was in 2008, and that wasn't a major. Like, that there's, I know that it's been incredibly wet there, and I know the greens are slow typically, just from reading about it and talking to our golf expert on the staff, Urmacher. I know Tiger typically prefers a faster green, like that he doesn't like that. And I also know you were talking about how the course used to go right to left and now goes left to right. And that potentially works in his favor. As far as just how this course is set up and how it works out for Tiger, what do you see on that?
Well, the course got redesigned. After that tournament got redesigned in 2005, and you're right, the contour of the course was right to left. Now, Tiger Woods, those who know him, know he prefers to hit the ball off the tee left to right. It's an easier bounce. The ball stays in play more. And when a when he knows where his driver's going, he can basically cancel out half of the golf course, and he can play more aggressive. What we saw last week in the BMW, I mean, what we saw last week at Firestone was hitting driver left, hitting driver right. So we didn't know where it was going to go. The rough is very, very deep. So I look for him to still struggle. Three out of the last five PGA tournaments, he has not made the cut. So him being a hall, based on the way the course is set up, the way he strikes the ball high, that is to his advantage. And he does have confidence coming down the stretch, Nick.
And he mentioned the hitting it high helps him in this tournament. He said because you don't get the run out, now that low stinger that he likes to hit off the tee isn't going to run like it would at a typical golf course, certainly not like it did at the British Open where it could run for an extra 100 yards. But he said he likes to hit the ball high. The last tournament that was held there, again, it's a decade ago, but the stats that were most indicative of who was going to win were approach, where you ranked in the field in approach, and where you ranked in the field in putting. One of those worked greatly to Tiger's favor. Approach game, he's still top 10, top 5 golfer on the tour right now. Strokes gained in that regard. The putting has been hot and cold throughout this year. And so that's something we're going to have to watch for throughout this. I wonder where he's at mentally after the great, what I considered a great British Open. And then what I think was disappointing last week. He played that tournament. It was the last Bridgestone Invitational in Ohio. He's won it 8 times, right? I think it's 8 times on that course. And for him to play on Sunday the way he did and on the weekend the way he did, I wonder where his headset's going into this week.
Well, one of the things about Tiger and his return, and it's been really refreshing, is his overall interviews and how much softer he is on the course. He mentioned, after shooting a great first round there at Firestone, his back began to get a little sore. It's the first time he's talked about soreness. So has that hampered his ability to practice as much? Because he is a gym rat as far as hitting golf balls. So we still have to remember, he's the first golfer ever to play on tour with a fused back. This is the end of the golf season. So what we might be seeing is a little bit of fatigue for Tiger Woods.
Certainly, you know, golf just seems to be more fun to watch when Tiger Woods is on the course completely, right? So if he doesn't win this, but he gets to the final cut, what do you think that does for him for next season?
It does everything for him. He continues to build on what, man, was a monumental comeback. Tiger talks about it. 7 months ago, he didn't know if he was going to be able to walk. He didn't know if he was going to ever be able to play competitive golf. He talked about the British Open there with his kids, got very, very emotional about how it's important for his kids just to have him as a soccer dad and be able to play soccer in the yard. So I think sometimes, because we think Tiger Woods is the greatest golfer ever, we just think that he was going to come back on the scene, but we tend to forget the number of back surgery that he's been through to get to this point. He's already had a successful golf season.
And if he can finish in the top 10, it's his first top 10 finish at a PGA Championship since 2009. This, of all the majors, we know he didn't play any majors the last 2 years, but the 2 years prior, he played the PGA, got cut both times. Mm-hmm. The year before that, now 5 years ago, he finished 40th. Like, this decade, he's been 28th, cut, 11th, 40th, cut, and then didn't play for 2 years. So any level of where he is, not doesn't have to be in the final group Sunday, but where he's still golfing when the broadcast gets going Sunday, like that would be an improvement as to where he's been in this tournament since 2009. And we both said we thought he'd win a tournament this year. If he doesn't win this week, he probably is not going to win a tournament this year. It still can be considered a success, even if it's not the official Tiger's back that will happen when he wins a major. And when he does that, I assume he'll win five or six in a row.
And I'm glad y'all said that. I think that's because he wins them all. No, that's true, though, right? I think a lot of people still think of Tiger Woods as a winner, right? And,
yes.
And that's the Tiger Woods we know and love. But to not marginalize, but adjust the expectations to something that's reasonable and realistic, I think is very well
Absolutely.
Done.
Absolutely. Tiger will win another major.
Yes. And this is a successful season.
Five
yes.
more.
Awesome. Coming up.
Needs to pass
is
there.
Dez Bryant any closer to signing with the team? Apparently, there's a huge recruiting pitch from a Pro Bowler. We'll talk about it next on First Things First. Here on First Things First, and we are going viral. Second year, Bears QB Mitchell Trubisky may have his starting job locked up, but he still has a reason to keep his eye on his backup.
What's up, guys? Chase Daniel here. Don't know if you can recognize me, but I'm going undercover today at Bears camp. I'm going to try to get some guys' autographs. Come follow me along. It's going to be pretty funny.
Jersey, Jersey! Jersey!
You're the best quarterback ever!
That's hilarious.
That's easy to do, man. Chase Daniels, I just saw him at the Hall of Fame game. And I was like, hey, man, they got a little kid on the field or something. They got him listed as 6 foot. But he, 5'11", 5'10". Chase ain't real tall.
He's carved out almost the ideal NFL career. He's made almost $30 million. He never has to actually play football. But, like, the few times he has, people think he's a good backup, could be a starter. So he never gets hit. He never has to, like, no one can tell if he's actually good or not, so he's always one of the highest-paid backups, just chilling.
Yeah, just chilling. He plays just enough so you don't have to chase him out of town.
Yeah, he was a great player at University of Missouri. Last time University of Missouri was really good at football, the year Chase Daniel had him very briefly number one in the country.
All right.
Next time we talk about Chase, he'll be doing something funny. Won't be quarterback.
Time now for some stories to start your morning. Aaron Donald and the Rams are still not seeing eye to eye on those contract talks, but it seems that the divide has narrowed a little bit. GM Les Snead told The Athletic, "We're in the same zip code." CC, how important is Aaron Donald to the Rams being a contender this season?
Oh, that zip code is cool, though. But they got some projects in certain zip codes. You could be in the same zip code. No, I need to be on the same block. Ain't that what I tell them, Nick? Mm-hmm. Hey, man, if you're going to compare me to someone, I want to be able to see their house.
That's right. Okay? Sometimes black to block. Black
yeah,
to
no,
block
no. You
different.
Can't be in the same zip code. They got railroad tracks, separation. They can still get you on that one. Les, no, I need to be able to see his house, Les.
And here's the problem. What Aaron Donald is worth in today's market is probably such a high number that it's hard for a guy at his position to produce that value. Like, I understand he is worth $20+ million a year with probably 60% of his contract fully guaranteed on a long-term deal, given that's what guys at his position can make if they're at the top of the market. But can he produce that much value against the cap? That's the push and pull here.
His biggest problem is Ndamukong Suh and the contract that he signed previously.
Correct.
Yes.
The one to go to Miami.
Teddy Bridgewater. Now, he's only played 9 snaps over 2 seasons, and he might not get one in New York. Apparently, the Jets are open to trading Bridgewater, but only at the right price. CC, is it a good idea for the Jets to go ahead and move on from Teddy?
Listen, we talk about our Jets, and we got friends that work in the office that are fans of the Jets, and the Jets didn't have a quarterback. Now they telling me, hey, you know something? I got 3 of them. Anybody want one of my quarterbacks?
Right.
And as you mentioned, 9 snaps in 2 years? No, Teddy, this preseason is very, very important for Teddy Bridgewater. But he doesn't have hardly any guaranteed money, so he is up to be shipped. They should be looking, if he plays well in the preseason, if they're going to ship him, probably to get a wide receiver because they still could use some big play help.
Hey, did you hear the Jets are thinking about moving on from Teddy Bridgewater? I never knew they moved on to Teddy Bridgewater. I mean, like the Teddy Bridgewater era. Oh, those 6 practices and OTAs. Like, I'm rooting for Teddy. If from what you've talked about, the people in Minnesota loved him. Mm-hmm. He was a great guy coming out of Louisville. He suffered a horrific injury to where they thought they might amputate his leg, and now he's going to be an NFL quarterback somewhere. I hope he plays in the preseason. I hope he plays well, and I do hope they trade him for this reason. Darnold's going to be the starter, and McCown's going to be the backup. So even if he goes somewhere where he's just the backup, that's closer to being a starter. And wherever he goes, they're going to have better skill position guys than they got in New York.
Maybe he'll see some action. We're moving on to Arizona. Now, the Cardinals rookie QB, Josh Rosen, he'll see his first preseason action on Saturday. The team hasn't quite announced how they'll divvy up the playing time, but we're sure that some of it will go to Rosen when the Chargers come to town. Rosen said recently that he's gotten better each day. So, Nick, why do you think all the noise and hype surrounding Rosen's kind of died down?
He's done a good job of not saying anything inflammatory, anything that we would grab onto, and he plays for the Arizona Cardinals. And CeCe's good friend for 20-plus years, Larry Fitzgerald, could tell you, that is a place where if you want to be somewhat anonymous, like as far as on the national scene, even a guy that could be a first ballot Hall of Famer in Larry, you can do it there. Mm-hmm. And so a rookie quarterback, the only reason we would be talking about Josh Rosen before he plays in a preseason game would be if he said something that made people mad. He hasn't said anything, and the Cardinals are the Cardinals.
And he's doing the right thing as a quarterback. Josh, what do you think? Oh, I'm getting better every day. Even if you're not getting better every day, the perception and being able to say the right things. They are going to be a run team with David Johnson coming back. And also they have their new coach who's a defensive-minded coach coming over from Carolina. So he's in a great spot to learn. And even if you're not getting better, say
this. Just keep saying
it. Nick, right. I'm getting better every day on TV.
Fake it till you make it.
It ain't true.
No. All right,
yesterday,
finally.
Yesterday, was average.
A day after, great. I thought you were great, Nick. A day after Jarvis Landry said Odell Beckham Jr. would love to come to Cleveland, Landry took to Twitter again to recruit Dez Bryant to the Browns. But Dez apparently is not that interested in going to Cleveland. Here's my question. Chris Carter, should Dez be being that picky? I don't know of any other offers that are outstanding on the table.
Well, I'm just going to tell you, if you're sitting at home, because a lot of times, you go through life and you look to people to get advice from them. Now, if your girlfriend is sitting home on a Friday night by herself watching reruns or something, don't go to her for dating advice, okay? Because she ain't got no date, you know? So first phone call, she should be like, I'm up and I'm available. Dez should be. Well, I mean, or don't say nothing.
Right.
Any team in the NFL is better than the team he played for, all right? Not with a team for several months. Now, we're getting a little danger territory now. Right. Because there might be information on Dez that maybe only Dallas knew and that maybe people in the media didn't talk about that now maybe the league knows. And maybe that's the reason why he only had one quality offer, and that being from Baltimore. Because right now, man, playing for the Browns like playing for New England. You in the league? I mean, that's better than the job he's got.
And being on a team before week one matters for Dez Bryant. Because people need to understand this. People say, oh, no NFL contracts are guaranteed. What is true is this. If you are a veteran, he is a vested veteran.
Yes.
If you're on the opening 53-man roster, your salary is guaranteed for
vested
the year.
Vested player meaning you've been on the NFL roster for four games for 4 years.
Right. For at least basically 4 years. So if you're on the opening day roster, your salary is guaranteed for the year. I'm not saying it's important for Dez because he needs the money. I'm saying it's important for Dez because if you're not on the opening day roster.
From a commitment standpoint.
Right. And the team can treat you week to week, then you might be one sideline outburst, one bad game away from them saying, you know what, let's bring up the kid from the practice squad. Dez might need a team where they are, listen, he's on our roster, we're paying him $3 million bucks, our owner's a little cheap, Haslam, like, let's make sure that we give him every opportunity to succeed. Like, it is more important for Dez than for a lot of guys out there that they're on that week one roster. Like, Eric Reed doesn't have a job yet, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, for him, it's totally different reasons. Eric Reed, if and when he does get a job, whatever team brings him in, he doesn't have to worry about them cutting him week nine. He's a quality player. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have the baggage that Dez has. Like, you can't be being picky. Like, unless his agent knows, listen, we've had an offer in the bag the whole time. Right. Like, they said they'll hold it for us, but that I don't think exists for them. And the Browns wouldn't be a terrible spot. Todd Haley's helped guys. Like, Baker Mayfield's going to be good potentially, and Tyrod Taylor's already around league average. Like, the Browns aren't – they're not the worst spot he could go to.
Are either of y'all surprised that we are this close to preseason starting and Dez really doesn't have a job?
I am. I had some timelines that – and at the beginning, I was like, oh, don't be concerned about it. Like, he'll be with the team. But there's also – I believe that there's also information that other people know that are preventing them from signing Dez or preventing from bringing that type of personality and that type of energy into their locker room. One thing about – what Cleveland is saying, because I just believe there's a concern there. If Jarvis Landry continues to talk about bringing other receivers there,
yeah,
what does that say about Josh Gordon?
Yeah.
All right, are they done with Josh Gordon? Because I'm sure Landry probably knows more than we do. Now, if my buddy was still dealing with something off the field and had these suspensions and I'm in that room, I wouldn't be campaigning on social media for some other wide receiver if I knew he was going to come back.
And we played the clip of Jarvis going at the heads of that whole wide receiver room. Now, maybe it doesn't matter, but it also, you wonder, if you're one of the guys in that room, not only is he cursing you, knowing it's on camera, knowing the whole world's going to get to see it on Hard Knocks, but he wants Odell. Now he wants Dez. Like, maybe you don't mind the Odell thing. Odell's a great player and one of his best friends. But now you're campaigning for Dez. Like, that, I think that's an interesting thing to watch.
There's
as well.
Not a lot of veterans in there who would give him a lot of pushback. And that's the reason why he can say it, and they paid him the money. Right?
Nobody's in a position to say why you offering up jobs.
Yeah, just like the show, the man with the money, he talks.
Oh, this guy, really, you got a lot going on today. I got you.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I'm not sure if y'all have heard, but LeBron James is no longer in the East, and that's good news for the Boston Celtics.
We're following him.
we're all over. Who lost to the Cavs in 7 games last season. And even though Kawhi is now in Toronto and the 76ers duo of Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons are yet another year older, don't tell that to Jaylen Brown, because he says, quote, "We're getting to the finals, no question about it." Strong statement. Nick, what do you make of Brown's comment?
It's a hell of a guarantee. Getting to the finals, no question about it. They probably would have got to the finals.
Is that an official guarantee, though?
We're getting to the finals.
No question about it.
I mean, I was with my man Joe Namath, and he said we're going to win. The guy said we're going to get to the finals.
This is more of a guarantee than Joe's. Joe's is before one game, you have to say, yes, we're going to win. Listen.
Why is it still the most famous quote before any Super Bowl?
Because he paid it off. Because they were the biggest underdogs ever, and he paid it off.
But he said, I guarantee it, though.
Okay.
This right here is a guy just talking. We're going to get to the finals.
Well, they might have got to the finals last year if he wasn't 5-for-18 in game 7. Like, I mean, just
he had a great year, though. He had a great playoffs.
And in game 7, he and the reason we don't remember that is because Terry Rozier was 2-of-14. So it kind of overshadowed those both their backcourt that game 7 just couldn't quite get it done. But here's my concern for the Celtics. Here's why I'm one of the few people that is not anointing the Celtics as the upcoming Eastern Conference champions. We know how great their defense was last year. I think they can do that again. They were the number one defense. I think they'd be a top 3 defense again. How much better does the offense get with the addition of Gordon Hayward? It gets better. But they were the 18th ranked offense in the NBA last year. Kyrie played most of the year. Like, that ranking, it's not like Kyrie was out. He was out for the playoffs. But their regular season offensive ranking, that is, how much better is the offense going to be?
A lot better.
How come?
Because they have better players. Their top 10 players are better. So not only is their first unit going to be more talented, their second unit is going to be more talented. So you're getting less 5 or 6 minute bursts from guys that aren't quality NBA players. You and I saw the Celtics roster. We was at the Garden. We were like, man.
They don't look really, really talented.
But now, top to bottom, outside the Warriors, who has more talent than them? Philadelphia's got a lot of talent. Like, but when you look at their roster, talent, and talent works, especially with a great coach. So that's how they get better, all right? They're 10 deep now.
So do you have any problem with the third-year player saying this before the season?
No, I don't have a problem. And young guys say things. It's not going to affect Kyrie. It's not going to affect, Horford. It's not going to affect, Gordon Hayward. Right. It's not going to affect the coach. What he will do is get more seasoned at given interviews. And, man, he's a role player. Right. He was playing a starring role when he was in the playoff. This team that he's coming back to is a team that's more suited for him and all the younger players. They don't have to get off every game. You know what his stats in the game number seven now? They're not going to be as important because you have Kyrie, because you have Gordon. So now, man, as the sixth, seventh, eighth players, some quarters I need you to maybe get 10 or 15, shut down a guy. So I believe their roles will be more defined.
That I fully agree with you on. And that's one of the things where Jaylen Brown was so impressive last year, not only post-Gordon Hayward injury, but post-Kyrie injury, where he needed to take on a much heavier scoring load. And up until that game seven, he was doing it. He was excellent. He was their best player in game six. Now, they lost that game as well, but he was their best player in game six. I do agree with you fully that next year, if Kyrie is your number one option, Hayward and Tatum are your 2-3 or 3-2, depending on how that shakes out, Jaylen Brown can focus more on what they drafted him to be, a great defender, a great athlete who has developed pretty quickly a pretty reliable three-point shot. I agree with that part in full.
And like the Warriors, they have the ability to sustain an injury or two. Are you starting guys missing with nagging stuff, even some not significant? They're able to do that. You also, you have to bake that into what teams could. Houston, last year they could do that. This year, they can't do that.
Right, and when CeCe says Houston can sustain an injury, he's not talking about to Chris Paul, but they sustained the Bamute injury.
Yes.
Fine. They lost guys Harden for a few weeks during the regular season. That was no big deal. Like, they had that level of depth. To me, every Celtics discussion when it comes to the finals, and it's for full disclosure to the audience, is also a Sixers discussion. Because that's the team
that was going to be my question, because you mentioned them too, CeCe. The Sixers got a lot of talent. Yeah, nobody's going to take that away from them. So let's say old boy's just talking here. What do the Celtics have to do to make that a real statement so that they are, I don't know, far and away, if you want to say, more likely than the 76ers to be in the finals?
The number one thing after Gordon Hayward getting back to full strength is Kyrie Irving's got to compromise. He's got to be able to give up the ball and be able to play within a system. We talked about Golden State and what they really do. Mm-hmm. The passing, that part is really organic. That part is magnificent to watch. Can the Celtics be that? Can Kyrie Irving be something that he has never wanted to be? And I believe that is where the team is able to grow.
And that's the point that I was alluding to with the Celtics offense being 18th. And I understand that was without Kyrie, and Tatum will be better and Brown will be better. But as good as without Kyrie for the end of the year, without Hayward for the whole thing, as good as Kyrie was before Kyrie got hurt, and he was scoring the same number of points he scored in Cleveland, it was still a mediocre offense. That's your point, is now that you have this other talent around you, this is the deepest team Kyrie's ever played on. This is the team with the most B-level players or above Kyrie's ever played on. In Cleveland, they had LeBron, so it offset those other things. The reason I said for me it's always a Sixers discussion is I think Joel Embiid's going to be one of the 10 best players in the league next year, and I think by the end of next season, Ben Simmons and Kyrie going to be eye to eye as far as best point guard in the East. And so if people think, oh, you're skeptical.
Don't forget
Celtics.
The mystery player, though. Are we going to talk about Philadelphia?
Fultz.
Yes.
Okay. Markelle
Fultz. Who is he? Where is he? And what kind of player is he going to be?
Because the Sixers got as much from Markelle Fultz last year as the Celtics did out of Gordon Hayward, which was nothing. And so for Hayward, it was because he broke his leg. For Fultz, it was because he got the yips after a shoulder injury. So I don't want people to think I think the Celtics are going to win 45 games. I think they'll probably win 55 games. I just think the Sixers might be better.
Oh, you definitely can never count out these particular Philadelphia Sixers. But coming up, one of the NFL's brightest stars has some harsh words for the reigning Super Bowl champs. We'll talk about it next on First Things First. All right, we're back here on First Things First. Super Bowl champ Chris Canty hanging out with us.
I'm back. Had a little coffee during the break.
In fact.
Get juiced up a little bit.
I appreciate that. So Alvin Kamara, he is headed into his second NFL season after taking home Offensive Rookie of the Year. Now, while New Orleans had a stellar year, they lost in crushing fashion to Minnesota in the divisional round. Kamara thinks that had they won that game, they didn't. But had they won it, they would have been unstoppable, telling Bleacher Report, we'd beat the out of the Eagles because we was rolling. If we beat the Vikings, I knew nobody was going to stop us. Chris Canty, what are your thoughts on that statement?
I think Alvin Kamara is talking real greasy, and that's so disrespectful to the reigning defending Super Bowl champs. I mean, I understand that they came one play from going to the NFC Championship game, but that championship game wasn't going to be indoors. That was going to be outside in the Link in January, and good luck with that, especially when you look at how that Eagles team was built. So I understand Alvin Kamara, year two, wanting to have some optimism coming off of being offensive rookie of the year. All of that's great. But when you start looking at what the Philadelphia Eagles did last year, the reason they were able to win that championship is because they had better big people than everybody else. Their offensive line, their defensive line played at a higher level. And guess what? Those groups got stronger this offseason. Jason Peters is coming back from an injury. You look at the defensive front. They got Michael Bennett in a trade. They brought in Haloti Ngata. Those two groups got better. So, I mean, when you look at those two teams, the Saints and the Eagles competing for a championship, you're saying to yourself, okay, the Eagles actually got better in that situation. I don't know if the Saints are going to be on par with that. But guess what? We'll find out in week 11.
Well, I'm not going to speak to what happened post-Super Bowl because that's talking about for this upcoming year. As far as this comment, I agree with him. I think if the Saints would have beaten the Vikings, they would have gone to the Super Bowl. I do think if the Saints had beaten the Vikings, especially the way they came back against Minnesota, a brilliant second half until the Minnesota miracle, because that offense was dead in the water the first half against the Vikings and then was great in the third and fourth quarters, the fourth quarter in particular. And I think we forget how Nick Foles had looked prior to the NFC Championship game. He was not good in their first playoff game. He was not good in the game against the Falcons that took them to the NFC Championship game. If we remember the end of the first half there, he tried to throw an interception and got his own guy tipped it away, and they ended up scoring on that drive. We would have looked at that as Breeze, Foles, the Saints rolling, and I agree with him. I think the Saints were, at that moment, the moment Stephon Diggs catches that football, everything up until that, the Saints to me were the best team. Now, Philly has gotten better, and Nick Foles got confidence and played great, and I take nothing away from what they did. I think right now they are the favorites going into this upcoming season for a lot of the things you say. But I think Kamara's right. I think that Saints team would have beaten Philadelphia last year.
Kamara's not right.
Thank you, CeCe. Thank you.
And Nick is wrong again. Kamara, this is what happens in the league.
Mm-hmm.
Kamara sat in that chair. I have been watching some film of him. He didn't even know how to run an option route. I was talking to him, hey, man, you need to do this. You need to stop bowing out because they can read it. They're going to undercut you. You need to straighten the guy up, put pressure on him. He was like, oh, yeah, thanks, man. You saw him doing that up and down the field, Sean Payton. Now he's even played one season. Oh, man, we whooped everybody. Man, we whooped everybody. Nick and I were at the Link, mm-hmm. at the NFC Championship. No one was beating the Eagles on that day. Ooh. In that crowd.
See, that crowd lit up on a Case Keenum pick. That crowd, right?
No. That crowd came to that game lit, all right?
They did.
Okay, true. But it was.
No. You stop. I'm not going to let people play fantasy football with real football,
right.
All right?
Right?
The Eagles, they don't match up bad against anyone, all right? The Saints do match up bad. The Vikings do match up bad against different teams. The Saints' defense wasn't as good as what Nick Foles did to that Vikings defense. Let's not forget what happened. Let's not forget the magnitude of that game. So, no, that you can't draw that conclusion. You had one play to make. You didn't make it in Minnesota. So all this hoping and praying and everything, like, you didn't win that game. And to think that you're going to make it to the Super Bowl over the Super Bowl champs, like, that's not the way the NFL works. I also saw a kid right here who didn't understand the NFL, and now all of a sudden now he's an expert on who's going to win, matchups and everything. I don't think so. This Philly team and that defensive front, it matches up better against the Saints than the Vikings in their front line does.
I'm just simple. And all this shoulda, woulda, coulda, I don't even understand it. To me, the whole statement is disqualified once you said, if we had, but you didn't. But you didn't.
But correct.
So what are you talking about?
Talk to Marcus Williams.
Correct. It's a right. game of inches. Like, no.
But he is talking about the reason he's saying if we had.
What he should be saying, Nick, is, man, I wish we would have had that opportunity.
That's what he should have said.
That would have been really nice to go there to be able to face that team in that crowd. Yeah, like, man, that would have been
with
a good game.
With the talent we had.
Because that's what we thought.
Yeah.
We thought that would be a good game, too.
In the Drew Brees era and the Sean Payton era of the New Orleans Saints, that has been a different team away from the Superdome. Especially, it's not the same team when they have to play outdoors.
The Minnesota game was indoors.
Was indoors.
Of course.
Okay.
And Drew Brees was still underthrowing passes. One of them ended up resulting in a turnover. So when you start talking about an aging quarterback having to go outdoors in January, it's not going to be as effective. And that team goes as the offense goes.
I get all of that. The point that I'm making is, and the reason Kamara, I think, can say this, is because it's not like that he's saying if we had won a game that they got blown out in, or if we had won a game that they were decisively beaten. He's saying if we had won a game, that for us to lose the game, the play that beat us is called a miracle. So it's as close as you can come to winning a football game with not winning a football
game. But the game was close, though, Nick. The Saints weren't blowing out anyone all year. So now all of a sudden, see, that's what I'm going. I'm going to blow out the Super Bowl champs. Like, stop.
That's a statement too far. That's fine. But if you're asking, do I think they would have blown out the Eagles? I shouldn't say I agree with that part of it. Yeah. But I think they would have beaten them. And I also think we have to remember that prior even to the Super Bowl, like, we were talking about the Eagles being disrespected because they were home underdogs in the playoffs, because they were people. Nick Foles was not writing books, best-selling author, a guy everyone wants to be their starting quarterback until, honestly, everything that happened after that Case Keenum interception.
Halfway through the first quarter in that game.
Yes.
But, Nick, you need to take people in that environment. Chris Canty, you have been there. And to think you are going to NFC Championship in Philadelphia, who's never won a Super Bowl, and you getting ready to beat them, I mean, you still got Similac on your breath, boy. Okay. You just now getting to the league.
Would you?
That atmosphere was real special.
Right.
All right? And they took that momentum from winning that divisional game and that NFC Championship game. That game was one-sided. The Vikings, I have the video. I have the video of the Vikings taking the field, and they did not look like a team that was getting ready to jump on top of the Philadelphia Eagles and that crowd and be able to beat them.
No, they looked like a team that had all the emotions sapped of them from the Minnesota
Miracle. Where do you think New Orleans is going to do? New Orleans had to jump on a flight, fly 3 hours, have a short week, and still come back on that Sunday night to be able to beat Philadelphia.
This is what I think. I think Drew Brees is not intimidated by the Link crowd. That's what I think. I think Drew Brees has not played the game Case Keenum does, and I think that game got away from them quickly at, like you said, at the midway point of the first quarter, things started going sideways.
Their secondary, the Vikings secondary, man. That's where they struggled. They give up too many big plays early.
I don't know why he might not be intimidated, but you don't have to be scared to get hit in the mouth. And that's exactly what the Philadelphia Eagles defensive front has done to every opposing quarterback all season long.
All right, so this comment aside, I want to ask all of y'all, what are reasonable expectations for this year's New Orleans Saints? I'll start with
you. Win their division.
Oh, okay.
Well, win their division. It's a stacked division.
Yeah.
That's going to be tough. I think it's the best division in football with three MVP quarterbacks. But I think the Saints told us with what they did in the draft, moving up from 27 to 14 to get Marcus Davenport, they're trying to compete for a championship. Yeah. It ain't about next year. It's about this year.
I mean, if it's reasonable expectations for any team to go to a Super Bowl, than it is for the Saints. Like, I think the Eagles, because they have Wentz coming back, that wasn't the case if they would have played. The additions you made. The Eagles are the favorites in the NFC. But after the Eagles, I put the Saints eye to eye with the Vikings, and I can't discount the Packers because Rodgers is there, and maybe the Rams. Like, they are right there in that group right beneath Philadelphia is the best teams in the conference.
I always mention on the show that I grew up in a housing project. Marcus Davenport, he is a project, okay? Now, if he makes a significant impact for the Saints as that number one pick, because he is a project.
Small school guy.
Read the clippings about him and what he's going through at training camp before we get all these projections.
It ain't good. It ain't good.
I mean, it's just called Reed.
Okay, NFC East going to be lit.
Come on.
Chris Canty, you sticking around? Even more coming up. Is Baker Mayfield about to prove the Browns right tonight? We'll talk about it on First Things First. Baker Mayfield.
I want to be a government official. How you grow up? Government cheese.
Now he'll look to do it again in an actual NFL game. Now the number one draft pick reportedly will play two quarters in Cleveland's preseason opener tonight against the Giants. Chris Canty, what are we looking to learn tonight about Baker Mayfield?
Well, I just want to see Baker Mayfield operate the offense. I want to make sure that the game is not too big for him. Now, I know Hugh Jackson, John Dorsey, they want to show him off a little bit because he is the number one overall pick. And so you want to justify that draft selection by being able to show some intangibles, some attributes that made you decide to take him with that high pick. So I think the things that we need to look at is getting in and out of the huddle, being able to have command of the offense, being able to operate with a little bit of tempo. And then I think a big reason why the Cleveland Browns bought Baker Mayfield in there is because they need somebody to try to change the culture. So you want to see that infectious enthusiasm from Baker. I think those are some of the things that you can look for in tonight's matchup.
When you say getting in and out of the huddle, like that is exactly the first thing I'm looking at. How many delayed games they have? How many timeouts do they have going into the two-minute warning? Meaning, like, did you have to blow timeouts? Like, what is the communication when they break the huddle? Is there 14 on the play clock, or are they running the line of scrimmage because there's 8 on the play clock? Like, that's going to be worse today than at any point, but I want to see how good it is today. You said the infectious energy or something along those lines. That's another thing. Our guy, Colin Cowherd and Baker, had a very, contentious or interview a few weeks ago where Colin pointed out, I see you celebrating your touchdowns. What about your teammates' touchdowns? And Baker went back at him well on that. You mentioned with Odell. I was just trying to remember who it was. Like, we know how happy you are when you score, how happy you are when your teammates score. I want to see Baker's level of, I don't know if they give us the opportunity at excitement when Tyrod's running the offense, when he's not out there. Things like that that I think are more telling than how accurate is he today. It's his first pro football game. It'll be the least accurate, the least comfortable he ever is. So I think those intangible things are maybe more telling than what's his completion percentage today.
Yeah, the first game, let's go back to his last game. Last game he played, best player on the field. His game before that, best player on the field. Probably the game before that, best player on the field. Now, there's a tremendous amount of excitement with playing your first NFL game. Now, you're not the best player on the field no more. So you have to be careful in the amount of energy that you're going to put out there because everything you're getting ready to do is foreign to you. Yeah. There's nothing he's going to do tonight that Oklahoma got him prepared. All when he transferred, when he was a walk-on, that got him prepared. This is the NFL, and the only thing that gets you ready for the NFL is the NFL. But we're starting to look at a lot of things when you're the first pick. Do they really, really matter? What kind of enthusiasm he has on the bench? Does it really, really matter? But if he was a second-round pick, would we care?
No.
So a lot of things is, man, play football. Be the type of person you are and try to be that as soon as possible. And it's hard to do those things. He's going to make some mistakes. Don't turn the football over. Don't fumble the football and get in and out of the huddle. If he's able to do those things in his first game, contain his emotion, you would consider it to be very, very successful. So let's just make sure that the things that we're watching are all football things compared to that we're just trying to pick apart a guy, because that's what we do to these stars that come from college, from the combine, from their pro days. What don't they do that we don't like? Oh, how tall are they? Are they really the right height? Are they the right speed? Are they right explosive? Listen, we want to see some football things, and that's what we should be judging him on, Chris.
And along those lines, you talked about speed, a little bit of it, and adjusting to the NFL game. I think that's going to be one of the big differences for Baker early on, just adjusting to that speed, because it's going to be a lot faster. He was the best player on the field in a lot of those college football games. He's not going to be the best player on the field. He's not going to be the best athlete on the field when it comes to these pro games.
Are the Browns playing at home?
What?
No, it's in MetLife.
Yes.
Okay, so now I would be even more focused. Now, if they're playing at home, I would go about it a little bit different because he is the Pied Piper. They're playing on the road. I would be more reserved. Don't be looking into the crowd. They're going to be saying everything to him that he thinks he's ever heard before. Yeah. It's a preseason game. Concentrate on your teammates. Concentrate on your fundamentals. Now, when you get back at home, those are the things that, as far as being a leader, being more boisterous, I think are more important.
And how difficult will it be, in your guys' opinion, for him to circle back to what Canty and I both alluded to, which is just receiving the play, communicating the play, and getting out of the huddle? Because that is the biggest difference, other than the speed, between college and pro football. Not going to be the pictures of Chris's head next to Mel Kiper's head. Like and Todd, by the way, they're doing it differently with Cleveland this year instead of Hugh Jackson doing it. First-year offensive coordinator with the Browns, Todd Haley's doing it. Like, how tough do you think that, not just for Baker, all the rookie quarterbacks, but we're talking about Baker Mayfield?
Well, he hasn't been under center a lot in his college days. That was one of the things that he had to get over. He's gotten hundreds and hundreds of reps doing that. But your voice in what you say as commanding the defense, which Canty is familiar with, or commanding that offense, man, you want a guy that gets in there the first time. I remember, and I hope he don't have no choice, Brad Johnson, Thanksgiving, playing in Dallas. And Billick called the play, and Brad was like blinking and stuttering. He's got a little southern drawl because he's from North Carolina. And I was like, Brad, scat right, double pump, on two. He was like, yeah, that one. He was like, we were able to laugh about it later on. But, right. Man, these NFL games, man, they are nerve-wracking. And the first one, you never have the type of jitters that you'll have for any other game.
That was going to be my question for both of y'all, because you have been there. The nerves, right? Like, and I know he's a big-time player, big-time Heisman, all this, that, and the third, but there's nothing like playing in pro football. Mm-hmm. So how do you shake the nerves?
Well, I think that the coaching staff can do Baker a favor in this situation by just allowing him to do some of the basics of the offense. The base systems are going to be installed for the first preseason game. Mm-hmm. So you're just operating, you're doing things that are very familiar to you because you've been working on them since you got to the facility day one. So I think mm-hmm. Baker will be put in that situation with the coaching staff, Hugh Jackson. They slow it down for him by asking him to do some very basic things.
Young defensive player, hit someone. That's how you get rid of the jitters. Young offensive player, quarterback, get me a completion, coach. Give me an easy route. Let me throw something out there, get something positive going.
Thank you for listening to the First Things First podcast. Remember, leave us a review and tell us what you think. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and catch us on FS1 Monday through Friday, 6:30 a.m. Eastern. For Chris Carter and Nick Wright, I'm Jenna Wolf. So long, everybody.